You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. This is Lecture 4, given in Dornach on March 24th, 1920. Our discussion yesterday afternoon was certainly extremely interesting. In connection with the question I see before us now, however, I must once again emphasize, as I have done before, that an adequate means of discovering the connection between individual remedies and individual disease symptoms can be supplied only after we have conclusively considered certain preliminary questions. Only then can we assess the implications of insights into the connection between the human being and the outer non-human world that serves as the source of our remedies. Without dealing with these initial questions, it is especially impossible to talk about the connection between individual remedies and individual organs, for the simple reason that this connection is not an entirely simple one. On the contrary, it is somewhat complicated, and we can gauge its actual significance only after dealing with the preliminary questions. That is what we will be doing today, and possibly also for part of tomorrow. After that, however, it will become possible to really explain concrete connections between individual remedies, or more particularly therapeutic methods, and diseases of individual organs. Today, however, there is something more I would like to say by way of introduction. I hope you will simply accept it for the moment, because it may be able to shed a certain light on a number of issues. And because of the initial shock of such matters, I must emphasize that they simply are somewhat shocking. Taking up what was mentioned here yesterday afternoon, I would like to ask you to look at the other side of the question. To our great satisfaction, numerous instructive cases of very specific cures were presented here yesterday. Footnote: the present lecture course, originally intended to consist of 14 lectures and last for two weeks, was extended to 3 weeks with 6 additional lectures. During this time, there were lectures by participants and additional gatherings, during which doctors presented cases for discussion, which Steiner attended whenever possible. End of footnote. Let us make a suggestion, if only so that you choose not to implement it, though it is very tempting to do so, about a very simple way of making these cures much less frequent. Of course, it is possible for me to talk about this only in a circle of people with experience in anthroposophy. You would simply need to do everything in your power to make Ritter's therapeutic method a matter of common knowledge and concern. Footnote: Marie Ritter died 1924 in Munich. Rudolf Steiner had visited her as early as December 1908. She developed therapies using light and color, which Steiner later stated are effective only while the illness remains in the etheric body. See Introduction to Using M. Ritter's Photodynamic Remedies, Munich, 1913, in German, and also in German, Neurodynamic Therapy, in connection with studies and empirical findings on the photodynamic effect of fluorescent and luminescent substances on certain cell areas and nerve endings, Leipzig, 1905. End of footnote. What you are failing to consider with regard to these therapeutic successes of yours is that you are standing there as isolated physicians. Of course, some of you may well be aware of individually having to do battle with the great majority of other physicians, and that as soon as you succeed in making Ritter's therapy a subject of study for the universities, when many, if not all, physicians begin using this method to cure people, and you find yourselves belonging to the majority rather than the opposition, you will experience a considerable reduction in your cure rates. Strange as this may seem, such things do happen in real life. Matters are sometimes completely different from how you imagine them. As an individual physician, you have the greatest interest in curing individual patients, and modern materialistic medicine has even found a legal argument of sorts for focusing exclusively on healing individuals. This legal argument consists in saying that illnesses do not exist. There are only individuals who are ill. If people were as isolated with regard to illness as they outwardly appear to be today, there would be some basis for this legal argument. But, in fact, people are not that isolated. In this context, what Dr. E. presented yesterday was very significant. Certain diseases tend to cover very broad territories, and if you have cured one person, you can never be sure how many others you may have saddled with the illness in another instance. You do not see the single case in the context of the whole process. So the details of such circumstances are very striking. But anyone who has the totality of human health in mind must speak from a different perspective. This is what makes it necessary to avoid a one-sided, merely therapeutic orientation, and to fully develop therapy on the basis of pathology. This is precisely what we will attempt here in order to bring some kind of rationality into what is otherwise only an empirical and statistical way of thinking. Footnote: regarding the nature of disease and epidemics, and their relationship to karma, see Steiner's lectures on title Manifestations of Karma, London, Rudolf Steiner Press, 1995, lectures 3, 4, 5, and 7. End of footnote. Today, we will begin with a fact that is generally known, but has certainly not been given its due in the context of scientific medical thought. A fact that can provide the basis for assessing the relationship of the human being to the non-human natural world. As you know, the human being is a threefold being, with a sensory nervous system, a circulatory or rhythmic system, and a metabolic system. By virtue of our metabolism, we human beings stand in a negative relationship to what is going on out in the natural world of plants. Please call to mind the fact that if we consider only the natural world's flora, we will notice that plants tend to concentrate carbon. Carbon becomes the basis of the entire plant kingdom. To the extent that we are surrounded by plants, we are surrounded by organisms or structures whose existence is based on concentrating carbon. Please do not forget that although the principle underlying this formative process also appears in the human organism, it is the very nature of the human organism to constantly negate this process in its nascent state, to destroy it and replace it with its opposite. The beginnings of this process are present within us, in what I have been calling the lower human being. There, we deposit carbon. Out of our own forces, we begin the process of becoming plants. But then our upper organization makes us resist this process. We negate the process by counteracting the carbon with oxygen, by processing it into carbonic acid. Thus, the internal process we must develop is the opposite of becoming a plant. Please pay attention to these processes that counteract outer nature wherever you may find them. For if you do, you will acquire an ever more thorough understanding of the real human being. You do not understand the human being as such if you simply weigh an individual, taking this as a symbol of all other methods of physical examination, but you immediately understand something about human mechanics if you consider that the brain is known to weigh an average of 1,300 grams. But if the brain bore down with its actual weight, if it exerted this amount of pressure on the lower surface of the skull, the entire network of delicate blood vessels would be crushed. The pressure that the brain actually exerts on the underlying surface does not exceed 20 grams. This is due to the fact that the brain, according to Archimedes' well-known hydraulic principle, has a certain buoyancy, because it is actually floating in cerebral fluid, so that most of its weight does not come to bear on the base of the skull, but is cancelled out by buoyancy. Gravity is overcome so that we are subject to buoyancy, the force that counteracts physical weight, rather than to the physical weight of our own organism. Similar conditions prevail in other human processes. In actual fact, we live within what physis, P-H-Y-S-I-S, or physical reality, sublates in us, rather than in what it does to us. Footnote: sublate, raise up and neutralize, but at the same time, preserve. Sublate. End of footnote. Thus, we are also not subject to any of the processes that we perceive as being present in outer nature and culminating in the plant kingdom. Instead, we live by sublating the process of becoming a plant. This is a very important concept to consider if we want to make the connection between the diseased human organism and phytotherapeutic substances. Footnote: phytotherapy, plant or herbal therapy. End of footnote. Now imagine the following fictional situation. We look at all the beautiful flora surrounding us in the world. We are highly delighted, and rightly so. It is different when we cut open a dead sheep and immediately experience another type of flora, which is brought about by factors similar to those calling forth the outer flora. When the odor of decay drifts toward us from inside the sheep, we are certainly much less delighted about the existence of intestinal flora. This is the main point to focus on, because clearly, in this instance, the same causes that give rise to the flora of the non-human, natural world must be combated in the human being to prevent intestinal flora from coming about. This opens up a very broad field of comparative research into the intestinal structures of different forms of animals, including the mammals, and going right up to human beings. I would like to recommend that you younger medical students use as much as possible from this field in your doctoral dissertations. This will prove to be an extremely rich field of research, because many very important issues have not yet been investigated. In particular, try to discover why a sheep, when we open its carcass, emits such a terrible stench of decay, and why this is not the case even with carrion-eating birds, which actually smell relatively pleasant when we open them up. These subjects contain a great deal that has not been worked through scientifically at all, as of now. Furthermore, there are numerous possibilities in this field for investigating intestinal morphology. Consider the fact that, on the whole, bird species differ significantly from mammals and humans. In avian species, you find that the bladder and colon are extremely poorly developed. Materialistic physicians like Dr. Metchnikoff of Paris made very great errors in considering these issues. Footnote: Elias Metchnikoff, 1845 to 1916, professor of zoology in Odessa, and later director of the Institut Pasteur in Paris. End of footnote. Colon-like structures and bladder-like bulges develop only in the large, flightless birds. This points to the important fact that birds lack the possibility of temporarily storing their excreta within the organism in order to eliminate them deliberately at an opportune moment. Instead, intake and excretion are continually being balanced out. We are taking a very superficial view of the matter if we imagine that diseases are caused by all the flora, and also fauna, as we shall see, that appear in the intestines or anywhere else in the human organism. Examining the literature on pathology today, in every chapter you come across statements about the discovery that this bacterium is associated with this disease, or that bacterium with that disease, and so forth. All of these facts are extremely interesting as far as botany and zoology of the human intestines are concerned, but none of it has any significance for illness, except possibly as a sign that allows us to recognize the disease. Because when one or the other form of disease is present, the human organism can be said to offer one or the other interesting little animal or plant a substrate upon which it can develop. It does not mean anything more than this. The growth of microscopic fauna and flora has very little to do with the actual disease, only indirectly, if at all. As you see, the logic that modern medicine develops here is very peculiar. Imagine that you discover a countryside where you find a large number of admirably well-fed, healthy-looking cows. Are you then going to say that everything you see is the way it is because these cows have somehow been flown in and the countryside has been infected with them? This thought probably will not occur to you. Instead, you need to investigate why there are hard-working people in this region, why the soil is especially suited to raising certain types of livestock. In short, you will most likely limit your thinking to all the possible reasons why the well-cared-for cows are there. It will not occur to you that what is going on is the result of the countryside having been infected and invaded by well-cared-for cows. But this is no different from the logic that modern medical science develops with regard to microbes and the like. The presence of these interesting creatures tells us only that the habitat suits them, nothing more. We need to focus on studying this habitat. Of course, other things can happen as a direct or indirect result. For example, we might say, there are well-cared-for cows in this area. If we add a few more, maybe a few more people will pull themselves together and start to work hard. And such a situation might indeed arise. Of course, it can happen that a bacterial invasion provokes a well-prepared habitat to succumb to disease processes of its own accord. In reality, however, current bacteriological studies have nothing to do with the study of disease. If people would pay attention to developing sound logic, these pronouncements by official science and their devastating consequences for sound thinking would be impossible. One issue that needs serious consideration is the fact that a certain connection between the upper and the lower regions of the human being, as described in the past few days, can be the cause of an incorrect interrelationship between these two aspects. The lower human being is predisposed to a process of becoming plant-like, and this needs to be arrested. But the forces active in the lower human being may be unable to stop this vegetative process if they are too weakly counteracted from above. This situation presents an opportunity for the development of an abundance of intestinal flora, which then become a sign that the lower part of the human body is not working in the appropriate way. The peculiar thing is that in the human being, activities that should be played out on lower levels are dammed up when they cannot run their course in the right place. That is, if the lower body is organized in accordance with certain processes that then cannot be played out there after all, these processes are pushed back. Although this may sound like layperson's terminology to some of you, these expressions are more scientific than much of the content of today's standard pathology texts. These processes, which under normal circumstances are meant to take place in the lower parts of the human being, are pushed back into the upper parts. We need to trace the origin of excretions from the lungs or from other upper organs such as the pleura by checking what is going on in normal or abnormal excretory processes in the lower part of the body. It is extremely important to take a good look at what happens when the lower part of the body pushes organic processes back toward the upper body. Much of what can take place in the upper body is nothing other than lower body processes that have been pushed upward. If the right interaction does not take place between the upper and the lower human being, then these processes are pushed up. Please consider one additional phenomenon. You are familiar, from everyday experience, with another circumstance that has simply not undergone the adequate evaluation that is essential for sound science. The moment you have thoughts about a particular organ, or to put it better, thoughts that are connected with any particular organ, the organ itself becomes active in a certain way. Once again, this is a promising field for future doctoral dissertations. Simply study the connection between certain thoughts that appear in the human being and salivation, for example, or mucus secretion in the intestines, or the secretion of milk, urine, or semen. Study how specific thoughts appear, paralleling these organic activities. What sort of a phenomenon are you encountering here? Certain thoughts appear within your soul life. Organic processes take place as parallel phenomena. What does this mean? Everything that appears in your thoughts is contained within the organs in question. If you have a thought and a particular glandular secretion runs parallel to it, you have drawn the activity that underlies your thinking out of that gland. You carry out this activity separately from that gland, leaving the gland to its own fate. As a result, it devotes itself to its own activity, secretion. Secretion is prevented, that is, whatever the gland would otherwise discharge remains united with it, whenever the corresponding thought keeps it united. This is a clearly visible example of how formative activity leaves our organs and enters our thoughts. You might say that if you had not been thinking in that way, your gland would not have secreted anything. You withdrew a force from the gland and transferred it to your soul life, and then the gland began secreting. There, you have in the human organism itself the most obvious proof of a statement I made in a previous lecture, that what we experience on the level of soul and spirit is actually nothing other than disjunct formative forces of the sort that shape what we encounter in the rest of the natural order. In the rest of nature, the formative forces that we withdraw from our intestinal flora are still present in the development of external flora, which parallels that of our intestinal flora. If you look around, outside at mountain and meadow flora, you must acknowledge that the forces inherent in them are the same forces that you use in developing your thoughts when you imagine something or have feelings. Your intestinal flora are different from the flora outside because the latter do not need to have thoughts taken away from them. The thoughts remain as intrinsic to the plants as their stalks, leaves, and flowers. This example will give you an idea of the relationship between what governs flowers or leaves and what goes on within you when you develop an intestinal flora but do not allow it to retain its formative forces. You take these forces away, because if you did not, you would not be a thinking human being. Your intestinal flora has had these forces taken away from it, but the outer flora retained them. This is no less the case with regard to fauna. Without insight into these issues, it is impossible to understand the connection between the human being and a phytotherapeutic substance. Similarly, without an awareness of the fact that we human beings are depriving our own intestinal fauna of the forces that bestow form in the external animal kingdom, it is equally impossible to conceive of the appropriate therapeutic use of animal serums. As you can see, a rational and systematic approach to these questions is possible only when we really take a look at the connection between human beings and their environment. But next, I would like to draw your attention to another matter that is extremely significant. I don't know whether many of you remember, it was some time ago, when these ridiculous prohibitions against spitting in public went into effect everywhere in the attempt to combat tuberculosis. Such prohibitions are ridiculous, for the simple reason that, as everyone should know, even ordinary diffuse sunlight kills tubercular bacilli in a very short time. If you examine sputum after a period of time, even after a very short time, there are no more tubercular bacilli in it. Sunlight kills them immediately. Even if the supposition of ordinary medicine were correct, prohibiting spitting would still be highly ridiculous. At most, such prohibitions make sense in terms of ordinary cleanliness, but not in terms of public hygiene in the broadest sense. If we, once again, begin to assess the facts correctly, this example is very significant, because it reminds us that the bacillus belonging to the fauna or flora of tuberculosis cannot survive in sunlight. The bacillus cannot survive there. It is not adapted to sunlight. But where can it survive? In the interior of the human body. And why can it survive precisely there? Not that it does the actual damage, but we do have to look at what is active in the diseased body. Here, we encounter a situation we have tended to disregard. We are constantly surrounded by light, and light, as you probably recall from studying science, is extremely significant in the development of non-human organisms, and especially for all the flora outside the human being. We are surrounded by this light. But something very significant happens to this light, which is purely etheric, at the boundary between ourselves and the outer world. It is, and must be, transformed. You see, just as the process of becoming plant-like is arrested by human beings, interrupted and counteracted by the formation of carbonic acid, which is active in the light, You see, just as the process of becoming plant-like is arrested by human beings, interrupted and counteracted by the formation of carbonic acid, what is active in the light is also broken off. Thus, if we look for light within the human being, it must be different, a metamorphosis of light. As soon as we cross the boundary into the interior of the human being, we find metamorphosed light. This means that we, human beings, are not only transform ordinary, tangible, natural processes within ourselves, we also transform intangibles. We transform light. We turn it into something else. If judged correctly, the fact that the tubercular bacillus still does well, the fact that the tubercle bacillus does well within the human being, but immediately perishes in the presence of sunlight, is simply evidence that this bacillus is in its element, in the product of the transformation of light that appears inside the human being. Therefore, if the bacillus thrives too well there, something must be wrong with this transformed light. Taking this finding as your starting point, you can realize that one of the causes of tuberculosis must be the fact that within the human being, who would otherwise not take in an excess of the ever-present tubercle bacilli, something that should not happen is happening to this transformed light, this metamorphosis of light. Tubercle bacilli are always present, although not in sufficient quantities, but they are superabundant in a person who contracts tuberculosis. Tubercle bacilli would not be present to such an extent if something abnormal were not taking place with regard to the process of transforming sunlight. I can present these ideas only as points of view, of course, but you will be overwhelmed by the empirical confirmation that you will encounter. If a sufficient number of dissertations and treatises are written on this subject, it will not be difficult to discover that what happens when an individual becomes a suitable breeding ground for tubercle bacilli is due either to that person's reduced ability to take in sunlight, or to a lifestyle that does not allow him or her to get enough sunlight, so that the appropriate balance does not exist between the sunlight entering the person and the light metamorphosing process. As a result, the person in question has to draw down reserves of internal metamorphosed light. Please take into account the fact that simply being human means that we always have an internal store of metamorphosed light. Our organization needs it. Whenever the interchange between the human being and external sunlight does not take place in the right way, metamorphosed light is withdrawn as needed, and in a way similar to the withdrawal of fat in weight loss. Human beings in this situation face the dilemma of either allowing the upper part of the body to become ill or withdrawing what the upper part needs from the lower. That is, making the lower part of the body sick by withdrawing its metamorphosed light. As you see, the organization of the human being requires more than transformed tangible substances that come from outside. Observing the human being correctly shows us that intangible or etheric substances are also present within the human being, but in metamorphosed form. This points out how the foundations we are now developing make it possible to develop a correct view of the healing effect of sunlight. For example, on the one hand, an individual may be directly exposed to sunlight in order to regulate the disturbance in his or her internal interchange with environmental sunlight. On the other hand, this person may be prescribed substances to take internally that will balance out the irregularity that arises when metamorphosed light is withdrawn. The withdrawal of metamorphosed light must be immobilized by what comes from the remedies. Here you have an example of being able to see into the organization of the human being. After some time, anyone who is at all capable of looking at the world begins, strangely enough, to rage in some way against all this microscopy, all these investigations on a minute level, because microscopy actually leads not toward, but away from a healthy view of life and life's disturbances. Excuse me for putting this somewhat undiplomatically. Although it would seem possible to contradict what I am saying, it is meant completely objectively, without any sympathy or antipathy. all of the processes that actually concern us in a healthy or sick human being can be studied much better on a macroscopic level than on a microscopic level. We must simply look for opportunities to investigate these processes in the macrocosm. Note that because their urinary bladders and colons are poorly developed, avian species are subject to a process that continually balances intake and excretion. Birds can eliminate while flying. They have no opportunity to retain or store the remains of their food. If they were able to do so, they would immediately develop a fatal illness. By being human, physically human, we have advanced beyond the development level of birds. This is in line with the modern view of the matter, but it would be more accurate to say that we have descended below the level of birds. Birds do not need to become involved in mighty battles against their intestinal flora, because they do not have any. In contrast, this is necessary for higher animals and human beings. But with regard to one of our somewhat higher capacities, for example, the transformation of the etheric factor that I have just discussed, the metamorphosis of light, we are on the same level as birds. We have a physical colon and a physical bladder, but with regard to our etheric body, we are birds as far as these organs are concerned. On the dynamic level, they are not present in the cosmos. We are dependent on immediately transforming the light we receive and eliminating the byproducts. If any disturbance occurs in this process, it does not correspond to a specific organ, and therefore cannot simply be tolerated without damaging our health. Thus, when we observe a bird with its little brain, we must be clear that this is a macrocosmic image of a more subtle organization. If you choose to study human beings with regard to the more delicate organization that imprints itself on our coarser organization, which has descended below the avian level, you must make a macrocosmic study of the processes of the avian world. At this point, I would simply like to state parenthetically that the outlook for human life would be very dismal if our etheric organism had the same idiosyncrasy as our physical organism in comparison to the avian species, because the etheric body cannot be so shut off from the outer world. If we had etheric organs of smell, the process of storing metamorphosed light, for example, would have terrible consequences for our life with our fellow human beings. It would be similar to what we experience when we cut open a dead sheep and have to endure its innards. As things stand, however, with regard to our etheric component, we encounter each other in a way that can be compared to the not at all unpleasant smell, relatively speaking, that is, everything is relative, that is evident on cutting open even a carrion-eating bird, or an animal such as a horse, which is not a true ruminant, but whose organization tends in that direction. Thus, the important point here is to investigate the correspondences between what happens in the outer flora and fauna, and what happens, but must be counteracted, in the intestinal fauna and flora within the human organism. And if we want to establish the connection between any therapeutic substance and a particular organ, we must move on from the general characterizations we have developed today to more specific characterizations, which will appear in the lectures to follow. Taking the need to counteract our internal intestinal fauna and flora as our starting point, let us now proceed to our circulation, where the struggle against becoming plant-like takes place, and then move on to the actual sensory neural aspect of the human being. This is much more significant for our life as a whole than we generally believe. Having raised science to such a high level of abstraction, we have lost all possibility of considering the human being as a being of nerves and senses in any appropriate way. We have been unable to consider the fact that this being of nerves and senses, which permits the light and the warmth associated with it to enter the human being as a whole, is intimately related to the life within us, since the intangible factors that enter along with the light must be transformed within the organs. Their role in the forming of organs is as important as anything that exists in the tangible realm. We have failed to consider that this being of nerves and senses is particularly significant for our human organization as a whole. As we descend deeper into the lower part of the human being, we move from the forces that build up the intestinal flora to those that build up the intestinal fauna. But when we ascend, we move from the realm where the internal flora is counteracted into the realm where the human tendency to mineralize or become sclerotic must constantly be combated. The increased boniness of the head is enough to permit you to study how the organization of the human being tends to become increasingly mineral-like as it develops upward. This tendency to mineralize, however, is extremely significant for the entire organization of the human being. Here, we encounter an issue that bears frequent repetition. I have even spoken of it in public lectures. If we divide the human being into three systems, as a being with a head, torso, and limbs, we really should not imagine that these three systems are adjacent to each other and separated by external spatial boundaries. Of course, qualitatively speaking, the human being is entirely a head being. What constitutes the head extends over the entire human being and merely predominates in the head. It is the same with the other systems, the circulatory system and the metabolic limb system. Each of them always encompasses the entire human being. As a matter of course, what is essential for the head being is present as a potential everywhere in the human being, and this potential for mineralization must be combated throughout the body. This constitutes a field of study that modern individuals cannot understand at all if they consult old texts that are the products of atavistic clairvoyance. Very few people gain anything sensible from reading what Paracelsus has to say about salt processes. But the salt process belongs to the field that I have just characterized. Similarly, the sulfur process belongs to the field that I characterized earlier. That is the process of becoming plant-like. So, we are dealing with an inherent human tendency toward mineralization. In a certain sense, just as it is possible for what underlies the activities of fauna and flora to become independent, it is also possible for the mineralizing tendency in the entire human being to become independent. And how should this mineralizing tendency be counteracted? The only way to do so is by splitting it up, by constantly driving little wedges into it, as it were. At this point, you will have to begin to make the transition from animal serum therapy and phytotherapy to mineral therapy. You will not be able to do without mineral therapy, because the clue to providing the necessary support in the human battle against mineralization or sclerotization can be found only in connections between minerals and the internal human element that wants to become mineral. You will not accomplish anything, and this will have to be thoroughly discussed in another lecture, by simply introducing a mineral in its outer state into the human organism. What emerges here points to an homeopathic principle of some sort, to the need to expose the mineral-derived forces that counteract the workings of the outer mineral kingdom. It has been pointed out, and quite correctly, that we simply need to take a look at the mineral content of some spring waters that have therapeutic effects, to see that a homeopathic process is evident in these springs. This process shows that as soon as the mineral's cohesion is released from the forces, we can grasp outwardly, completely different forces emerge. These forces must first be released in a special way through potentization. But as I said, these topics will be discussed in a separate lecture. There is something else that I would still like to tell you today, and I ask that the younger people among you especially take it to heart. If you perform actual comparative studies of the transformation of the entire intestinal system as it evolves from fish through amphibians and reptiles, especially amphibians and reptiles, to birds on the one hand, and to mammals, and ultimately humans on the other hand, you will find that remarkable transformations occur. Some examples are the appearance in lower animals of an appendix, or what develops into the appendix in humans. The beginnings of an appendix in some birds, which may be thought of as something of a deviation of the avian organization from its usual path, and the manner in which the colon evolves as we move from the fish species, which have no such organ, up through the so-called more highly evolved orders to those with actual colons, and then to those with appendices, some species have several of them, and on to the human being with a full-fledged appendix. You will find a remarkable interaction taking place in all this. A comparative study would need to heavily emphasize this interaction. You could simply inquire in a superficial way, and you know how frequently this is done, about the purpose of an organ like the human appendix, which is closed off toward the outside. This question is frequently asked, but when people ask such questions, they usually do not consider the fact that the human being manifests as a duality, and that anything taking on form down below is always parallel to an organ that appears up above. Certain organs cannot appear in the upper body unless their parallel organs or counterparts are able to develop in the lower body. The more the forebrain develops in the course of animal evolution, eventually assuming the form it has in the human being, the more the intestines develop in the direction that leads to storing the remains of food. There is an intimate connection between the formation of intestines and the formation of the brain. If the colon and the appendix had not appeared in the course of the evolution of animals, physical human beings, who can think, would also ultimately not have been able to appear, because humans have brains at the expense, at the very pronounced expense, of their intestinal organs. The intestinal organs are the faithful obverse of the structures in the brain. To make it possible for you to be relieved, on the one hand, of physical activity for the sake of thinking, you must burden your organism, on the other hand, with everything that gives rise to the need for a fully developed colon and bladder. This means that the highest activity of soul and spirit in the human physical world, to the extent that it is bound to the full development of the brain, is also bound to the corresponding development of the intestines. This is an extremely significant connection, a connection that sheds a great deal of light on all of natural creation. If you ask yourself why human beings have an appendix, The answer, paradoxical as it may sound, is so that they can think in a way that befits human beings. What develops in the appendix has its counterpart in the human brain. Everything on the one level corresponds to something on the other. This is knowledge that we will have to achieve again through a new type of cognition. Today, of course, we have little to gain from simply parroting the physicians of times gone by, who still had some grounding in atavistic clairvoyance. But we must indeed acquire this understanding again, and a purely materialistic study of medicine that does not look for such connections at all is a real obstacle to doing so. As far as today's science and medicine are concerned, the brain is an internal organ, and so are the contents of the lower body. No one notices that this error is just like saying that positive and negative electricity are the same. It is all the more important to observe these things, because just as tension develops between positive and negative electricity and seeks to balance itself out, there is also constant tension in the human being between the upper and lower parts of the body. The primary goal of all our searching in the field of medicine should be to master this tension, which is expressed in the forces concentrated in two organs, the pineal gland and the pituitary gland, or hypophysis. All of the forces of the upper body are expressed in the pineal gland, and a state of tension exists between them and the forces of the pituitary or hypophysis cerebri, which are lower forces. This relationship is a true state of tension. If we were always to derive an idea of this state of tension from a person's overall state of health, it would be a very good basis for further healing. We will continue talking about this subject tomorrow. You will see that I will incorporate all of your questions, but as I said before, I must first create the basis for doing so. The end of Lecture 4.